directly after the failure to be able to cast out this unclean spirit. And it's as if they start looking around. And of course, Peter, James, and John were with Jesus, so they didn't get a chance to show that they could have done it if they would have been there, which I don't know that they would have either. But as part of this of going, have you ever noticed in a situation that whenever there's a big failure, people want to really quickly point out that it's not their fault? And they want to start to kind of figure out, well, who's really the greatest that's here? And to go, you hear this kind of conversation come up often. And I want you to realize how fleshly of a conversation this really is. I mean, can you imagine if we said, okay, well, who is the greatest female in this congregation? Now, do you think that's a healthy conversation? I mean, if you were to switch that around and turn into a masculine question, do you think that would be a healthy conversation? Yet, what do we find people want to know so quickly in situations? Who's best? Who's better? What's... And knowing full well who is definitively the best of this relationship of a marriage we have with Christ. Is it the bride or is it the groom? It's the groom. It's not anybody else other than Jesus. So here you look at it. They come in and notice their question, who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Now, you look at this, and of course, this is kind of Matthew. Just know if you ever see kingdom of heaven in the gospel accounts, you're always dealing with Matthew. There's a rare exception of that through Mark, Luke, and John. So it's really a key that's part of the gospel of Matthew. And so he says, who's greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And you imagine, here they are, these disciples, and it's really the apostles in other accounts. They come to Jesus, they have a question. If you didn't know the next verse or two, what would you anticipate he would say? I'm right here. But I want you to notice what Jesus does. And I want you to notice what true greatness does. Look at who he calls for. Because you can imagine among those 12, they were thinking it was one of them. Verse 2. And he, Jesus, called a child to himself and set him before them. Now, there's some passive things that take place in verse 2 that I want to make sure and bring a spotlight to. It says, Jesus called the child to himself and set him, the child, before them. What did the child do? Obeyed, but there's something you have to do before you obey. What is it? You have to hear or listen, right? He says he called the child to himself. I mean, can you imagine whether he called the child by name? I don't know. But he called the child to himself, and then he set the child in front of them, which tells you the child was listening for the voice of Jesus. And whenever he heard his voice, he obeyed it. Now, do you think that child might have wanted to do something different? It's a possibility, but we don't know. So here's the situation, and then you get verse 3. And said, truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now remember, what's their question? Greatest, what is Jesus dealing with first? Just getting in. He doesn't immediately go, well, let me tell you who's the greatest. He says, well, let's deal with getting into the kingdom of heaven first. Let's deal with entrance before we deal with ranking. Now, he says, I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm going to be up front with you, which is not as if he was never untruthful, but he's making a point. This is it. Don't miss it. He says, unless you are converted and become like children. Now, I want to do a little wordsmith on the word converted here. Typically, when we hear converted, we think in terms of, okay, convert 36 inches to feet. How many feet is 36 inches? 3 feet, right? How many yards are 36 inches? One. A lot of times when we think about convert, we think about taking something from one measuring unit to a different measuring unit, but it's still the exact same length, right? Is that the kind of conversion that Jesus is talking about? He's not saying, unless you just retitle the way that you talk about your life, then you can't enter. It's like, that's not it at all. Now, does anybody have a little footnote in your text for converted? Turned. Changed. Now, he says, unless there's a turn and a change, he says, you will not enter where? The kingdom of heaven. So I just want you to be careful whenever you see the word convert and not come up with kind of an English thinking rather than what Jesus is really going after. He says, this has to be converted, has to be changed over and turned. And whenever you think about a turn, whenever you're driving, changes where you're headed, right? I mean, if you want to get to the kingdom of heaven, you're going to have to make a turn. There's going to have to be a change. Now, notice how he talks about this. He says, to turn, to change, and this change will make you like children. Now, I remember one time, I was in Arkansas at the time, and teacher got up and started talking about this, and they just started talking about all these things about children and all this different stuff about, oh, here's what's really neat about children, and here's the things about children. And you go, that's not what he's going after here. He's going to make his point, so let's make sure and pay attention to his point. He says, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, you've seen all kinds of children in your life. You've seen some that you go, that might be the sweetest child I've ever seen. There's some other children you've seen, you might go, that might be the rottenest child I've ever seen. So look at what he's dealing with. Verse 4. We'll come back to that converted idea. Verse 4. Whoever then humbles himself as this child. You think there's a reason Jesus called that child to himself? What did he know about that child? He was humble enough to listen and obey. He says, whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. He says, do you want to know what the qualifications are for the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? What does he tell you? He says, you're going to have to humble yourself. Not wait to be humbled, not be put in a humbling situation. You're going to have to humble yourself. And humble yourself to become attentive to the voice of Jesus. Let's see, what did Peter, James, and John just hear on the mountain? Listen to him. He says, it's interesting. This child knows enough to listen to me and obey. But sometimes the adults have a real problem with that, right? Now, but if we've turned, if we've converted, who did we have to turn away from in order to turn toward Jesus? Ourselves. He says, if you're going to do it your way, are you going to make it into the kingdom of heaven? He says, you won't even find entrance if you're not going to humble yourself to listen and obey. And then he goes so far to the next aspect here in verse 4. He says, whoever, he says, he just leaves it wide open. He says, you tell me if you want to be the greatest, because this is all it takes. it really makes it sound very, very easy, simple. We want to make it really hard. Jesus says, no, it's really very simple. He says, whoever then humbles himself as this child, and he points to this one child in particular. He's not talking about every child. He's talking about this one that you just got introduced to in verse 2. And you see the outcome. The outcome of Jesus speaking and humility coming together is obedience. He says, whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Now, I want to talk about a point of view that we have that they didn't have yet, because we have the advantage of looking back through the end of the gospel accounts that they didn't have yet. What did Jesus do to become the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? He humbled himself to the point of what? Death. Who was he obedient to? His Father. Think about how far he was willing to go. He says, I know this is what my Father commands me to do, and this is what I'm going to do. And is he already aware that he's going to die? Yeah, because he just talked about it in chapter 17, didn't he? Does he already know that he's also going to be raised on the third day? Yes, he's just as confident in one as he is the other, because who told him both? His Father. And what's really unique, Luke's account talks about the Mount of Transfiguration, and it tells you that Moses and Elijah were talking to Jesus about his departure in Jerusalem. Isn't that a conversation you would like to have an ear to? What are they telling him? So, here is this layout, and I want you to see how deeply seated this is about truly striving. And sometimes I've heard half-hearted Christians go, well, I don't really want to be the greatest, I just want to be in. That's not humility. Humility is like, well, how much do I have to listen to make it? 100%? Striving with everything we have? That's all. Not thinking, what's the minimum? What if that's the way Jesus approached the cross? Is that the kind of attitude God's looking for? You know, whenever Jesus calls the child to himself and sets him before him, he's like, all right, if I have to, all right. It doesn't even tell you any of those things. But you know the child obeyed, and he sets him right in front of this group of men who are thinking about themselves and goes, this is what you need to think about. Now, just so that you know, we're right on target. Look over at Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. Look at verse 8. Just before here, it's talked about how that Jesus empties himself. And that's what it takes to find humility, is to empty ourselves. And we're not really quick to do that sometimes. Verse 8. Philippians chapter 2, verse 8. Being found in appearance as a man, look at what he does. He humbles himself. Even Jesus had to do this. I mean, think about what aspect is it really talking about when it says he humbles himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. What's the scene that you see whenever you read verse 8 in the life of Jesus? He gives his all. And what point in those last 24 hours of Jesus' life before his death, are you considering the scene for this? Remember being in the Garden of Gethsemane? What does he pray for? He says, let this cup pass from me, this cup of wrath. He says, let this cup pass from me. He says, but not my will, but your will be done in talking to his father? What is he choosing? Humble obedience. There are times where we look at what God is commanding and we go, I'd like there to be another way. I'm praying that there would be another way. And God says, no. Sometimes he says no. Now, what happens whenever you tell a child no and they don't want to hear no? You hear about it. You get resistance, right? And usually it gets to be a more difficult situation than what it was before, right? Have we grown up enough to realize that whenever we say no to what God desires, that things are about to get more difficult? As opposed to going, you know what, I need to humble myself. I need to choose. I'll do it his way. Now, if you notice it here, I want you to see how far this takes Jesus because of this mindset. He says, humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death. And then it adds this little tag onto the end. Even death on a cross. Why does it add that tag at the end? What does it change in the application for us? Even through these great difficulties, even through excruciating circumstances, is that an excuse to say, okay, I don't have to humble myself anymore? No. Yet a lot of times we're looking for the exception to the rule, aren't we? On why we don't have to listen to what Jesus says here. Why I don't have to show them mercy. I don't have to show them grace. And who do we make it harder on? Ourselves. And we wonder, how come it's getting so difficult and so hard? And we don't realize it's because I haven't humbled myself. Now, look for Jesus. Look at where this attitude takes him. Verse 9. For this reason also, what reason? That he humbled himself. He says, for this reason also, God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name. Who's the greatest in the kingdom? He is. Why? Because he humbled himself. You see what he was doing with that child in Matthew chapter 18, Jesus was already doing. But he wasn't going to put the spotlight on himself. He was going to make these men think about this child and go, this child's got something figured out that you men haven't yet. At least for this moment. Now, if you notice how far he goes, he says, this is what humbling yourself and being obedient will take you to. Because here's Jesus, verse 10. He says, so that the name of Jesus, every knee will bow of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth. Is there any other place to be? What's he telling you about the universal kingship of Jesus? He reigns in heaven. He reigns on earth. And he reigns in hell. He reigns. Don't believe the old comic strips of that Jesus reigns in heaven and the devil reigns in hell, because he does not. Jesus reigns. He reigns over more than what we see and what we know. So whenever you look here and you see this statement of those who are in heaven, on earth, and under the earth, verse 11, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father, he says, you will know it. And someday everyone is going to confess. And some will be in heaven, and some will be under the earth. But everybody will recognize this point. So should that change? Since we know what the future is going to be, you think we should let that affect us now? You might as well go ahead and convert and turn now to be obedient. Now, you notice these things together. Come back. Well, actually, while we're away, look over at 1 Peter chapter 5. First Peter 5:5. I'll pick on myself. Notice who the first ones to be addressed in this verse are. You younger men. Now, he's just talked about shepherds, and he's talked about Jesus as being the chief shepherd. So you get to verse 5, and he says, you younger men, likewise. In the same way as you see your shepherds submitting to the chief shepherd, he says, you need to be subject to your elders. He says, which tells you, our shepherds, our elders, should be showing us what it's like to submit to Jesus. And now he says, you young men, because guess who really struggles with wanting to humble themselves? Young men. Now, it's not as if they're the only ones, but it's pretty easy to start thinking of stories along those lines that you've seen in your life. But then he changes it, and he says, and all of you. But specifically young men, you better have your warnings on about yourself. He says, and all of you, clothe yourselves with humility. Who's got to do it? You do. We all do. I mean, and I love this picture of clothing. In the same way that you chose what clothes you put on this morning, you're going to have to choose your attitude. Is it going to be one of humility? Did you choose that this morning when you're getting clothed? I'm going to choose humility today. I'm going to choose it tomorrow, and I'm going to choose it the day after that. I didn't choose it so well yesterday, maybe. Sometimes it takes the failures to see it. But here's the aspect. This is part of that conversion, part of that turning. I want you to see what we're turning away from. He says, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Why is it so wonderful to be humble? What do you find? The grace of God. Anybody want to walk away from the grace of God? I hope not. If you do, just choose pride. You'll get there really quick. It's the shortest walk you'll ever have. You might not even have to take a step. But if you choose pride about self, what are you also choosing as your enemy? Who are you choosing as your enemy? God. Because God's opposed to the proud. He stands in opposition to, isn't that what you call an enemy? Someone who stands in opposition to you? And so here he brings it together to say, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Come back over to Matthew chapter 18. Tell me the grace that this child received. Who did he get to be with? Jesus. Isn't that something? Is that a grace? Now, I want you to take this here, and whenever he makes a statement, verse 4, whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. He says, this is what it looks like. And it's as if Jesus could have said, if you'll just pay close attention to me, I'll give you the example of what to follow in. I'm not going to ask you to do something I haven't already done. Now, here he is, verse 5. And whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. What does this tell you about Jesus' attitude toward children? He loves them. He loves them. And he says, if you receive them, he says, it's just like you're receiving me. Now, I want you to think about what that means in this moment. Because now, here's this child, this boy. It is a masculine. He says, it's a boy who's right here, who is attentive to listen to the voice of Jesus, responds out of humility to obey Jesus, and now is there with Jesus. And now here's Jesus saying, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And how are you going to treat this child? Here's someone who's good. He says, you want to know what greatness looks like? This is greatness right in front of you. And now how are you going to treat this child? Are they disposable? Are you to be impatient? Are you to be abusive? He says, because whatever you would do with this child is the way I see you treat me. Now, how easy is it for us to lose our patience with children, especially when they're naughty? Right? Now, I know sometimes we look at this and we go, yeah, Jesus wouldn't act like that with whatever child. But he doesn't say that. He says, however you receive this child is how you're receiving me. Susan. Right, this total dependence upon Jesus to provide, and I think in those same senses. And so, sounds simple. Now it's just about putting it into practice, right? So I know a lot of you have grandchildren, and of course children too, and going, sometimes grandchildren can be kind of trying. There are times, and there are other times where you go, this is the greatest day that I've had in a long time. But of going, all right, how am I going to treat this child? Does that mean, okay, well, I just give this child everything they want? That's not love. That's not what God did with his son. He didn't say, oh, you don't want to go to the cross? Fine. You just don't have to go. Instead, he provides for him. If you remember in that garden story, you remember that there's an angel that comes from heaven to strengthen him? Instead of taking out the obstacle, he insists, says, let me give you strength. And there's still anguish in the moment. I mean, the agony that he's going through in the garden is documented in Luke. But you also go, look at what God is willing to do when people will humble themselves. And so all of a sudden you start to look at children and go, and how can I help you? How can I help instruct you? And you realize sometimes you run into children that aren't humble. They don't want to listen. And you go, you have to let them fail to show, okay, here's your thinking. You use your own thinking and then you fail. And I don't come back with, told you so. That's not humility. What is that? That's more of a pride side, isn't it? Karen. Right. Right. It had been communicated. And now it was about, am I going to keep my word on what I said would happen? And realize that's another aspect of going from the parent or grandparent side of going, am I willing to keep my word? If I'm going to make rules, as one superintendent once told me of schools, he says, rules are overrated. Because you still have to keep them. You can't just make statements and laws and then go, okay, that's just great, and not keep them. And so you think about those things here. He says, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. Now, real quickly, look at chapter 19. And look at verse 13. And hopefully we'll get to this in 2 weeks. But I just want to make sure we remember the connection. It's always interesting to me, marriage and divorce is verses 1 through 12 in Matthew 19. The very next story is about children, because marriage and divorce has an effect on who? Children. Verse 13. He says, then some children were brought to Jesus, to him, so that he might lay his hands on them and pray. And think about what they've just heard in chapter 18. And the disciples rebuked them. And let's see, how does Jesus take that? Who are they really rebuking? Him. Him. Verse 14, but what does Jesus want to do here? Verse 14, but Jesus said, let the children alone and do not hinder them from coming to me, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. That should have been a red flag where they went, oh, we just talked about that, didn't we? And how many times as a parent did you tell your kid something and 5 minutes later, here they go. And you go, oh, forgot. Forgetter's working overtime. And you go, you look at this and to go, he says, this is it. He says, the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. Verse 15, after laying his hands on them, he departed from there. But it shows you, did Jesus really care about children? And did he care about their development? Not just about physical side, but of going to really look at the way they think. And so whenever he sees children, all of a sudden, here are these mean disciples who are saying, get out of here. He rebukes them. And then Jesus would go, hey, you leave them alone. Because sometimes you need somebody who's really spiritual to tell somebody, look, you need to leave that child alone. You need to stop what you're doing. You need to think about it here. Now, here it is when you come back to chapter 18. Jesus is telling them something they're going to quickly forget. Because what's their real question about? Themselves. Who's the greatest in the kingdom? Of us. And Jesus is telling them, you're not even going to get in. Now, here's another aspect of this. Who of this group of the 12 is not going to make it into the kingdom of heaven? Judas. And why? He doesn't humble himself. Now, some of the others have a little bit of trouble on that on the front end here too, but they're going to become obedient. They're going to have some moments where they go, you know what? We did it just the way Jesus said was going to happen. He says, you're going to strike the shepherd and the sheep are going to be scattered, and we scattered. But now we're back. Some people certainly thought that way, not necessarily everybody, but probably as a standard norm among some. And so you see what Jesus does in taking this child, which tells you the way we need to see children, to go, there's great value here. And some need a whole lot more help than others because of situations they've been through. You know, sometimes you have parents who are leading their children down the darkest paths. And I'm not talking about abusive situations. I'm talking about just in the way they teach them to think. Make it about you. If you want it, you go get it. And you go, that's not healthy. So teaching them about humility, about how I think about times whenever children or grandchildren actually do respond out of humility to do what's right, even if it's just one little thing among some others, to give them praise for it. To go, that's what I'm looking for. You think they'll appreciate that? And they'll go, how do I do that again? You want to reinforce what's good. You think about it. Sometimes they do one thing right, but it's surrounded by a couple of things that weren't a little iffy. You go, but let's talk about the one. Let's make sure we're encouraging here. And if those other things are iffy, let's deal with that too. But let's deal with it rightly, with a calm voice in dealing with things. So here he is. He says, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, which tells you how personal Jesus takes it. How you interact with children, Jesus says, that's a good reflection of how you see me. And sometimes that's not a good reflection. Sometimes it's a great reflection. Then, verse 6, but, big but, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, in other words, they're old enough to have some faith about Jesus. Now, I mean, you're really talking about young ages here. You think about a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old. They can have trust about Jesus and believe. They can have some faith response about, I know this is what Jesus wants me to do. That's just one of the sweetest things. I ever hear a 6 or 7-year-old say, you know, what do you think we should do in this situation? Not always giving them the outcome, but letting them learn to think. What do you think we should do? Well, you know, Jesus wants to tell the truth. Oh, okay, well, let's go do that. And then you get to learn the outcome and work together and learn. Now, he says, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, you get to the same situation, you go, well, let's just not go back in and tell them. I know you took that off of the candy rack as we were leaving and we didn't pay for it, but it's no big deal. What are you leading that child to do? To stumble. What we're saying is, as long as it's on a low enough level, it's okay. It's only the big things that really matter. See, Jesus ever say anything like that? Now, what did he say about the small things? If you'll be faithful in the small things, you'll be faithful with the big things. And you go, oh, let's do this like Jesus would. So you start to see how we go about this can really be influential. Now, he says, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, he says, and stumble is a parallel for sin. He says, it would be better for him. Better. Good, better, best. It would be better for him to have a heavy millstone. And those things weighed about 1,000 pounds or more. It would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. What is Jesus trying to communicate here? How you treat children? It's serious. He says, let me tell you, if you're not going to be patient with children, he says, it would be better. If you're going to guide these children away from God, faithfulness toward him, you think in terms of this, of going, you know what, to have a grandfather or a grandmother or a mom or a dad be hypocrites in their faith? Are we leading that child to stumbling? And it's nothing like when a child calls you out, is it? And he says, it would be better if you were not around anymore to affect this child and your life to be over than for you to affect this next generation that way. Is he not trying to communicate seriousness? Is he not trying to communicate, are you going to humble yourself to be obedient to your heavenly Father? Andrea. Really, it doesn't matter about age. It doesn't matter in terms of, you know, if they're 17 and we know that they understand things, or whether they're 3 and they are very limited. It shouldn't affect, because that's what you see with Jesus, right? He doesn't say, well, you're spiritually mature, so I'm going to treat you. And this person's a little bit, they're still in Christ, but, you know, they're immature. You know, he's going to be the same all the way through. And that's kind of the beauty of, let's see, is that Hebrews chapter 13, where it talks about Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever, of going, this should be the same no matter who we're dealing with. And I know there can be different situations that pop up, but you see what's here and to go, this, I mean, could he say it more emphatically? This is serious. And yet, what do you know these disciples do with this just one chapter later? They forget what is supposed to be a focus. Does that ever happen to us? We ever lose focus? Frustration come in and we lose that? Now, this is not some statement of going, hey, you know, we've all completely failed and we're miserable at this. This is about, let's just look for room to improve. That's really what he's going after here. But they have yet to find, are they really listening to the voice of Jesus yet? Not totally. Because in the very next chapter, they're going to forget what he has told them right here. And Peter, James, and John just got a special thing up on top of the mountain to say, listen to Jesus. And it doesn't take long to forget. Sometimes I can forget, it doesn't take minutes, about what Jesus said. And nothing crazier than reading a verse and going, oh, that's awesome. And then all of a sudden you get to a point in your life and you go, I completely forgot what I just learned. And look at what I got for it. Now, you see these things as he continues on. Then notice how it hits next. Verse 7. What's the first word? Whoa. Whoa. Now, real quickly, I just want to show you something. Look back at Matthew chapter 11. Anytime you see this word, whoa, I want there to be another word that comes into your mind right alongside it. Let's see if we can figure it out. Matthew chapter 11, look at verse 21 and 22. What's the first word of verse 21? Whoa. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the miracles had occurred in Tyre and Sidon, which occurred in you, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. If they would have seen what you've seen, they would have repented and changed. Here's the part. Remember, verse 2 has, woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. He's talking about a woe to each one of these different cities. Verse 22. Nevertheless, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. I want you to notice this, and I wish we could plow through this field all day. Whenever you see the word woe, I want you to think about the word judgment. Because whenever he starts declaring woes, now, there's about 99 times in Scripture that the word woe shows up, or verses that it shows up in. Sometimes it's multiple times, like here in one verse. 63 times in the Old Testament, 36 times in the New Testament about woe. If you look at the context of them, you will find in each situation when God or a prophet or Jesus says woe, it means you are coming upon a judgment of God. If you don't change. I mean, this is kind of that kind of language that whenever Jesus starts saying, whoa, the hairs on the back of our neck should stand up and go, what is coming? Now, what was he saying to Chorazin and Bethsaida? There's a judgment. And if you don't change, he says, if these things would have been done in Tyre and Sidon, he says, they would have changed. And they were some wicked outcasts. He said, but not in you. You're too smart for that, I guess. He says, the judgment's coming. Now, come back over to Matthew chapter 18, verse 7. Woe. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks. Anybody got an exclamation point? Yeah. Why the woe? Because what's coming? A judgment. He says, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come, but woe to that man through whom the stumbling block comes. Because what's coming upon that man? A judgment. Now, once again, what is he emphasizing? Does it matter about how you treat children? Yeah. Now, you thought we were talking about seriously before. He's going to bring it into focus again. He says, and stumbling blocks, can you expect them to come? Yes. I mean, you can expect this from the world. He says, woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks. He says, it's just filled full of them. He says, don't be surprised when they come. Don't expect worldly people to have righteous behavior. That's insanity. Then, verse 8, If your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. Now, I want you to think about that. Think about this statement. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off using your other hand. Cut it off. And whenever you get it severed, you take it and you throw it away. What has strength, use it to get rid of the stumbling block. And then he switches around to the other end of the body, and he says, what if your foot causes you to stumble? Can your hand cause you to stumble with a child? How many parents, whenever the children are younger, do not have a physical advantage? What about your foot? You can kick. You can kick a child. He says, what if it causes you to stumble? What should you do? You just cut it off. Which, once again, what is the overall thought here from Jesus? What does this matter? This is serious. This is serious. He says, for it is better for you to enter life crippled or lame, crippled, lacking a hand, lame, lacking a foot. He says, then to have two hands or two feet and be cast into the eternal fire. Because if you don't deal with it right now, then you will deal with it later, eternally. Then, verse 9, if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it from you. Remember one time as a kid over at somebody else's house, they started a movie, and it starts with a spoon being gouging out an eye. I don't recommend watching them. But that's what I think of when I see this. And going, what would it take for me to go, that's something I need to do? And to realize, then you better deal with it now. Don't wait for later. Now, you go here, he says, pluck it out. And then notice the next part is not just to pluck it out. You notice how in both illustrations he uses the same aftermath? And throw it away from you. To think of, to throw it. I mean, you imagine an eye being like a golf ball and going, he says, throw it. It is better for you to enter life with one eye. Anybody here just be willing to give up an eye for no reason? I hope not. He says, it'd be better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be cast into the fiery hell. I mean, can you imagine the intensity of this conversation? Do you think anybody's over there just twiddling their thumbs going like, oh, he's talking about this again? And yet at the very same time, you know what's coming in the next chapter. How easy it is to forget. You can understand why he rebukes them in chapter 19. So you see these things together and you understand children are to be treasured. But they are not to be spoiled. They are to be shown the things of God in the way that God does them. And if we don't recognize that, then it's time for some extreme moves. Now, I want you to think about it. Just because you cut off your hand, because you cut off your foot, because you pluck out your eye, does it really change what's going on in your heart? No. So what really needs to change? Your heart. I need more. How many mothers and fathers have prayed for more patience? What? It's interesting. I've heard that a lot, but really all it is awareness. Now you're aware of what's going on, and you notice that it was all there before. Just a matter of now. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's what this is about. So you see these things together. Verse 10. And remember, woe is always tied to judgment. And what is Jesus showing them? If you don't correct it now, what's coming? A judgment. And at the same time, what if we've made mistakes in the past? Well, you'll be grateful to hear that the second half of this chapter is about forgiveness. So I don't want that to escape our attention, because sometimes we can get through these things and go, oh, I feel like it's terrible. I messed up everything. And you go, well, let me tell you about the grace for those who are humble. Look at what's offered. Then, real quickly, verse 10, see that you do not despise one of these little ones. Don't look down your nose at them. They may be a snot-nosed, rotten kid. That doesn't mean to despise them. He says that means they need a whole lot of help. So are you going to be part of the solution or the problem? He says, for I say to you that their angels in heaven continually see the face of my Father who's in heaven. He says, do you understand that God takes special care, that he looks after these things? And I know we've seen children that have gone through some terrible, terrible things. But to realize God has a way of bringing about a greater grace. I tell you, it's one thing to see a child that's gone through a physical abuse of by their parents and to know that it gets documented, and then to know that that child gets to be brought into a loving home and to go, what a way out. They don't have to stay there forever. And to see the blessing that's in that. That's hard to see, though, isn't it? Now, you see some parents that shouldn't be able to walk or move their hands, and yet you see grace of God when they humble themselves. Then he says, their angels, their messengers in heaven. Oh, they're part of the kingdom of heaven? He says, and they have angels in heaven that see the very face of God. Do you know what? At this point in time in Matthew, if someone was to see the face of God, I'm not talking about Jesus, what would happen to them? They would die. He said, their angels stand in the very presence of God and see his face, and they don't die. They're there as messengers. I want you to think about this. Angel is a messenger. If you do something to a child, who tells the father? The angel does. Sometimes people want to take this verse, oh, they have guardian angels. That's not what we're really talking about here. Don't think that you can mistreat children and God won't know. He already knows, and there are angels who stand in his presence who are going to tell the truth. Once again, awareness. Awareness. Seriousness. And to go, are you ready to humble yourself? Are you ready to be obedient? And then, of course, verse 11, for the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost, and I'm here to save you. I'm here to save you if you failed. What a beautiful thought. Just beautiful. And, of course, as we deal from this point forward, it's going to be about forgiveness. So that's just as important to know as it is the first part of going, what if I failed? And you have a God who's ready to show grace to the humble. And what a wonderful thing. Any questions or comments for you? Right. Right. And to see the patience of Jesus with them.